Basel III Endgame will make it harder for consumers to buy a house or a car. It'll hurt the small businesses that rely on loans to grow, and it'll reduce savings for people with money in pension funds. Regulators propose capital requirements would take a toll on families, seniors, farmers, and small businesses. Washington, scrap Basel III Endgame and start over.
You know, being in school in the 90s, like that's when I was in elementary school, when I was taught about the birth of this country, I just learned a lot about Christopher Columbus and how he discovered America. And, you know, that was really all it was for me.
A century ago, a violent white mob razed the heart of Tulsa's thriving Black community.
So we're at the 100-year mark of the Tulsa Massacre, where so many Black families, so many Black homes, businesses were just essentially massacred in 1921.
Oklahoma is now swept up in a national culture war over how schools teach kids about racism and sexism.
The problem that I think that's really happening, though, is the timing.
We just hit the 100-year mark of the Tulsa Massacre. And very soon, a state law will take effect that will severely limit how educators teach concepts that could cause students guilt or discomfort due to their race or gender. Concepts like systemic racism and inequities in society.
And so a lot of people see this as, you know, a slap in the face.
Politico's education editor, Delise Smith Barrow, has been watching this play out.
Part of the culture war that we see playing out in Capitol Hill is, how much do you want to have that conversation? How much do you think it's worth revisiting? And how exactly do you explain it to someone who might be 8 years old and you're worried about being overexposed? And I think progressives are like, no, these 8-year-olds are underexposed.
And right smack in the middle of this battle is Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
This is about American history and the most important dates in American history.
Welcome to Playbook Deep Dive. I'm Ryan Lizza. How'd McConnell find his way into this fight? Well, he recently sent a letter, signed by dozens of his GOP Senate colleagues, demanding that the Federal Education Department yank back its recent push for American history and civics education grant programs, basically programs where they'd update history curricula to more fully flesh out the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans. Why the GOP pushback? Well, in part because the Biden administration's proposal cited the New York Times Magazine's 1619 Project.
My view, and I think most Americans think, dates like 1776, the Declaration of Independence, or sort of the basic tenets of American history. I simply disagree with the notion that the New York Times laid out there that the year 1619 was one of those years.
Okay, so you're probably familiar with the 1619 Project. It highlights slavery and its legacy as a central element in America's story.
And it got this national interest and praise. And then for much of Trump's presidency, he had a very antagonistic relationship with the New York Times. So now he's seeing the New York Times get a big win, a huge win.
And in response, the 1776 Project that McConnell is referring to was created by then President Trump to support what he called patriotic education.
We will stop the radical indoctrination of our students and children and restore patriotic education to our schools.
You know, it's November 2020. It's kind of odd to launch a commission when you don't know if you'll win the election, because technically this was the day before Election Day. We were in a pandemic. You know, there were all these things happening. But yeah, he took the time to say, you know what, I'm really going to push this commission. And so I think it became a federal battle.
President Biden terminated that program earlier this year. So how did we get here? And where is this battle headed? From states like Oklahoma to inside the Capitol. Basically, education reformers on the left and conservative traditionalists on the right are fighting over core definitions of how American history is taught and how much the state and local governments should guide school curriculums. It's a fight about the meaning of who we are and where we came from.
You totally hit the nail on the head.
McConnell is turning this fight about education policy, which previously might have been the subject of an occasional Fox News segment, maybe a nasty Twitter fight, into a core piece of the Republican platform.
It took many by surprise because McConnell is calling out the Department of Education on a somewhat small grant program that typically doesn't draw a lot of attention, typically isn't very controversial.
It's interesting that Mitch McConnell has jumped on this issue. Here he is at 79 years old, figuring out his place in the Republican Party since Trump left office. And with Biden now in the White House, he's wanted to focus Republicans on rallying against Biden's spending plans and social welfare proposals, sort of traditional GOP positions. But instead, most of the Republican Party has been way more interested in these cultural issues around things like race. And so there was a pretty significant moment earlier this year when Mitch McConnell jumped on the 1619 Project and critical race theory as a sort of unifying issue for Republicans. He's a politician who thinks of himself as a master Senate strategist, someone who is most worried about figuring out where the center of gravity is in the Republican Party. My favorite example of this is at one point in his life, Mitch McConnell, for instance, was pro-choice. So he has a long history of moving to the right along with his party. And the moment this year when he embraced this particular culture war battle was a recognition that even McConnell, who, if it were left up to him, would probably rather be talking about taxes and spending, even he decided that this was an important issue that Republican leaders needed to be associated with. McConnell personally hates Donald Trump, but even he has realized the Republican Party still needs a dash of Trumpism.
What really kind of got him riled up is the fact that in these proposed priorities that the Department of Education laid out is that they essentially praise the 1619 Project, which President Trump really, really disliked. He openly railed against it. He found it very divisive and very inaccurate. And so I think for Mitch McConnell to see the Department of Education under President Joe Biden embrace the 1619 Project, embrace anti-racism curriculum and teaching and things like that, I think it was too much of a 180 for him. And I think he felt like the Department of Education was almost taking a jab at the Trump administration and anyone who felt like teaching anti-racism was bad. I mean, the Republicans are essentially saying, if the federal government is endorsing this collection of essays and other work from the New York Times that forced pretty much everyone to revisit how this country started, the contributions of Black Americans, how much slavery and discrimination was woven into our history, I think that they looked at that as a way to get people focused too much on racism at a point in the party where they're trying to say, we're not racist. We are inclusive. We had Tim Scott even publicly say the United States is not racist.
Hear me clearly. America is not a racist country.
We don't need anyone kind of going against this theory, this idea. And so he writes this letter to the Education Department, and I think things snowballed from there. And whoever was maybe quietly fuming about anti-racist curriculum and teachings and books and things like that, I think those people felt empowered to speak up and say, you know what, I don't like any of this either. And I think it's going to make white students feel bad, feel ashamed, and we've got to stop it.
Talise, let's just back up a little bit and explain what precipitated Mitch McConnell's letter. It was something that was posted in the Federal Register, right?
Right.
And there were two examples of suggested or recommended curriculum. You talked a little bit about the 1619 Project. What was the other one?
The other part that was mentioned in the Federal Register that really got Mitch McConnell riled up is the mentioning of Ibram Kendi. He's an anti-racist scholar, very well regarded, well known, and he has been instrumental in teaching the masses about what it means to be anti-racist, just what the core definition of that term is, how to be anti-racist, and just kind of waking people up in terms of why we should even care about this term, this thinking, and what we're teaching our kids.
Delise, for people who don't understand, people who have never heard of Ibram Kendi, Ibram Kendi has become a newer buzzword in the culture wars.
Yes.
Dr. Ibram X. Kendi.
So says my guest, Ibram Kendi.
Ibram X. Kendi, can you respond to what's happened over the last few weeks?
If you watch a lot of Fox News, you'll see segments about Ibram Kendi and you'll be taught to be scared of him, right? You mentioned this term anti-racism that Kendi is most famous for defining. How does he define that? What is at the heart of his ideas about anti-racism?
First things first, I'm totally not a scholar, so my definition should not be cited in anyone's dissertation or the like. But I think with Ibram Kendi, much of his work kind of centers on not taking a passive approach or passive thinking when it comes to recognizing racism or pushing back against racism. I think for a long time, it was this notion of, I'm not actively contributing to racist ideology, racist policies, racist laws. I'm definitely not racist. And I think, you know, Kendi has really challenged people to say, you know, not doing anything is still doing something. You know, you're still contributing. You're just doing it passively.
For someone who's been living under a rock, spell out for me briefly what's going on right now in Oklahoma and other states on this issue.
Sure. So Oklahoma, in their state house, there was legislation proposed that would severely limit how public school students learned about systemic racism, gender discrimination, things of that nature. So the governor, he approves of this, he signs it into law, and it goes into effect July 1st. The problem that I think that's really happening, though, is the timing. So we're at the 100-year mark of the Tulsa massacre, where so many Black families, so many Black homes, businesses were just essentially massacred in 1921, 100 years ago at this time. And so a lot of people see this as, you know, a slap in the face, like we're hitting the 100-year mark of one of the worst acts of racism, violence, hatred, and for the governor to say, actually, I'm going to sign something into law that might make it more complicated to teach about the Tulsa massacre. I think to many in Oklahoma and around the nation, that's just seen as entirely backward. Now, the governor said, you know, this is not to say that you can't teach about the Tulsa massacre or slavery, but there are some caveats to how you teach it. And it has a lot to do with you can't say or do or imply anything that might make white students feel bad, feel guilty, feel ashamed. That's such a hard call. You know, like if it's a student who had never heard about the Tulsa massacre, and essentially these were white people attacking Black people. And if you explain that to a student and it makes them feel bad, do you put that on the teacher or do you put that on the history? It's hard to tell the history without being frank and saying this is what happened. And these are all the people who died. And once it happened, it's not like the Black residents in Tulsa were taken care of. There wasn't like a massive outpouring of federal support to rebuild their businesses, rebuild their homes, make sure their survivors, you know, had money to go to school or any of these things. A lot of these people were just kind of left on their own to rebuild their community, their homes, their lives. And so I think the timing of the centennial of the Tulsa massacre and this law could not have been worse in a lot of ways. And it just caused such an outcry. So the governor is kind of in the hot seat.
Joe Biden went to Tulsa, Oklahoma. I don't remember another president honoring that history the way that Biden did. Did he make any reference to these education battles that are going on? Did he weigh in any way? And why or why not?
I don't think he did from the coverage I was following. And in terms of why he didn't, so I have a couple of guesses. One, in Oklahoma, like I was saying, the law goes into effect in July, right? So that's, you know, in some ways it's a done deal. Even if Biden doesn't approve of it, doesn't like it, like now it's law. He can't quite stop that. He can maybe do some things that would make it more difficult, I don't know, for maybe Oklahoma to implement it, maybe, but it is law. So that could have been one reason. And then number two, I think that he was trying to, in some ways, acknowledge and uplift, you know, acknowledge that this horrible thing happened, but uplift the community and saying, I'm here for you. You know, I'm not going to let people continue to not know that this happened. I think a lot of us did not learn about it in schools, or maybe it was just a sentence. And I think that if he had focused on the education battle, it would have taken away from the uplifting, right? Because you're basically saying you had this massacre that happened 100 years ago, and now you have this law that will make it really difficult to teach about this massacre.
We'll be right back.
Basel III Endgame will make it harder for consumers to buy a house or a car. It'll hurt the small businesses that rely on loans to grow, and it'll reduce savings for people with money in pension funds. Regulators propose capital requirements would take a toll on families, seniors, farmers, and small businesses. Washington, scrap Basel III Endgame and start over.
And we're back. Let's talk a little bit about the politics of this issue. How is the anti-racism teaching battle ripping through DC politics right now? What's happening behind the scenes, as far as you can tell?
So after Mitch McConnell wrote his letter to the education department, Virginia Fox, so she's the minority leader on the House Education and Labor Committee, and she's been on the committee for, you know, for quite some time, has a great amount of influence. She proposed some legislation at the federal level that would also make it difficult to teach history in a way that could be perceived as divisive. So we have kind of Mitch McConnell leading one area of this fight, and then we have someone who's actually a member of an education committee in Congress also saying, I agree with Senator McConnell. We need to do more. We've put pressure on the department. We're going to try to put some legislation in place to really kind of tamp down on things so that we don't have any state feeling like it's the right move to embrace the 1619 Project and incorporate any of it in their curriculum or any of Kendi's work as well.
So Trump decided this was going to be one of his final issues,
right,
of his presidency. Mitch McConnell's now glommed onto this. And recently in North Carolina, the architect of the 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah-Jones, has been all over political Twitter because her tenure was denied, seemingly because of political pressure. Tell me how all of these threads are connected.
Sure. So Nicole Hannah-Jones, she really did lead the coverage of the 1619 Project. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist for the 1619 Project. And essentially, she was supposed to be a tenured professor at her alma mater, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, teaching about much of what she's written about. And the Board of Trustees at UNC Chapel Hill, after further review, they've expressed some concern and instead said, well, we can give you a 5-year contract and then we can talk about tenure. And I think it just goes to show that there has been a significant effort to discredit the 1619 Project and to question any type of teaching that would continue some of the work that came out of it. So North Carolina is one of the states that has had legislation that will be similar to Oklahoma, where, you know, teaching about anti-racism or gender discrimination or anything like that, it would be much more difficult. So when you think about what's happening in the state, this piece of legislation, even the fact that it was proposed and maybe moving through the channels of becoming law, even to know that that's happening in the state and that you're going to bring in a very famous professor at the state's flagship institution, a nationally or internationally known university. I think it just all kind of came together, and people with a lot of power were able to say, you know what, we need to really take a step back and consider what bringing her to our campus would mean for the state. When you think about what's the state legislature plus this professor, it's kind of at odds, right? You can, on the one hand, say we need to be more selective about how we teach about anti-racism and then bring in the person who really put 1619 Project on the map, who really opened so many people's eyes into how the country started and when the first slaves came over and what life was like for them for hundreds of years after, and their descendants. So I think we've been headed down this road for quite some time, where it was going to be some type of national explosion of some sort. And we're seeing it right now. You know, Nicole Hannah Jones, she's contacted her lawyers. Hundreds of people at UNC have written a letter kind of saying, we don't agree with this. We've even seen NBA players, celebrities also speak out on this. We have never seen this much focus on education, a history class, essentially. This is not like a full throttle curriculum overview where it's math and science and all these things. This is kind of, you know, in some ways narrow. But when you have that much outcry and pressure, and some of the professors who have protested or the celebrities, they said, you know, if this doesn't change, we're going to have to rethink our invitations, our relationships with other big name universities if you don't make this right. And so I think it's the political pressure, now the celebrity pressure, and we don't really know where it will end, but we were always headed here.
Delise, the debate over how we frame our history in schools has been going on forever. What makes this battle different?
I think truly what makes this battle different is, so once the 1619 Project came out and it, you know, got this national interest and praise, there were some school districts that said, we definitely want to incorporate this into our curriculum. Like, this sounds wonderful. So on the one hand, we had that. And then for much of Trump's presidency, he had a very antagonistic relationship with the New York Times. So now he's seeing the New York Times get a big win, a huge win. And it has a long lasting win if a school says, we're going to teach this, like this is going to live on for years or decades later. I think that kind of thrust it into the national spotlight, because the then president's essential like open war with the New York Times was heightened. And he tried to come back with the 1776 commission. You know, it's November 2020. It's kind of odd to launch a commission when you don't know if you'll win the election, because technically this was the day before Election Day. We were in a pandemic. You know, there were all these things happening. Most kids weren't even in school. But yeah, he took the time to say, you know what, I'm really going to push this commission because this is what I value. I'm no fan of the New York Times. And so I think it became a federal battle. And then, you know, the commission, it was launched and there was people on it. And so I think that is very different from what many education reporters saw happening at the school district level or at the college level. This isn't the first time UNC Chapel Hill has had to kind of grapple with history as it relates to slavery. They have they've had a Confederate statue on campus that for many, many years was controversial. Well, this isn't the first time that they faced this, but I think this is probably the first time that we've had it start with one president and continue with the next president because of these proposed priorities that the education department has. So I would say that's truly the difference.
What does this mean for the president? What does this mean for Joe Biden?
We have two issues happening with schools. We have this argument over what and how students should learn about this nation's history. But the bigger issue is just getting kids back in school. Like, what they learn, when they learn it. It's important, but it's honestly secondary to, are they even in class? Like, can we find them? Where are they? A lot of students went missing during the pandemic. They never logged into Zoom, or they only logged on.
Tell me about it. I've got a 12-year-old who spent the whole time on Fortnite instead of in his classes.
Exactly. So that's become such a big issue, and that will be such a marker of Biden's presidency. Like, can he get these schools open? So my inkling is that that just supersedes everything. And the thing about putting it in the Federal Register, so once you propose something, people had 30 days to weigh in and say, this sounds like a great program, you know, essentially the thing in the Federal Register. It's like a grant that you can apply for, and one of the, they kind of spell out, you know, you're more likely to get the grant if it's something in line with the 1619 Project.
Right. So there's a reason. There's a reason those that stuff is in there. It's not just...
It's not arbitrary. You know, it's very clear. Like, this is the type of thing we're looking for from an applicant. This is the type of thing where, you know, it would heighten your chances of receiving it. But nonetheless, they've had a chance for people to weigh in. And once people weigh in and say, this sounds like a great change, or this sounds like an awful change, then the Department of Education will say, okay, we'll make a final decision about next steps. You know, Biden might be biding his time, you know, like letting it play out and focusing on number one, like, are you learning anything? And we can get into the specifics and the weeds when you're back in class.
Yeah, yeah. Looking ahead, the real test to many progressives is how hard Biden fights for voting rights reform. Do you think he's willing to press the Mansions and Sinemas of the Senate to abolish the filibuster? Or is he, as many people suspect, much more focused on getting infrastructure done?
I think he's much more worried about getting infrastructure done. You know, he started his presidency with some really aggressive goals, some really, really big agendas. And much of that is wrapped up in the infrastructure packages that he's proposed. So my guess is that that will be number one. And worrying about the mansions and what happens with the filibuster will just be secondary. And again, like, I just can't emphasize this enough. We're still in the middle of the pandemic. Now we have this new kind of 4th of July goal of returning to some type of normal life, or maybe a new normal that feels better than the 14, 15 months we've lived through. So I think the filibuster is of top concern, but I'm not sure if it matches some of these other pressing issues.
What do you think this might mean for the midterms next year in 2022 and Democratic and Republican campaign strategies? Will this issue be a campaign issue?
I think this will definitely be a midterm issue. I think a lot of people will use it to say either, look how the Democrats are dividing our kids, our innocent kids, and molding them into focusing on hate and things that we don't want them to focus on. And other people will say, my state is doing everything that it can to be more inclusive, since we know in the past, a lot of you felt left out when you were learning. You were the only brown person in class. You didn't hear about people who look like you, and we're trying to correct that. We already know that former Secretary of Education under Obama, John King, you know, he's running to be the governor of Maryland right now. He's running on a platform that largely focuses on education. Of course, it looks at other things, because as governor, he'll, you know, have to be looking at healthcare and housing and things like that. But much of his career, if not all, has been wrapped up in being a leader in education. So we're likely to see and hear a lot from John King about, you know, helping younger people through education, making sure they have the tools that they need to transition into the workforce, but to also know where they come from, know their history, know that they're a valued member of this nation, and, you know, showing that value by saying, we're going to acknowledge what you and your ancestors did in the curriculum, right? But the fact that we have someone of John King's stature running for governor, and this is his platform. He's not a former congressman or anything like that. He just was the Secretary of Education, and that is his grounding. So I do think in the future, we'll see a lot more, we'll see a lot more races where people talk about what kids are learning and maybe their perception of the 1619 Project versus 1776 in the midterms and beyond.
And then are Republicans falling in line behind McConnell since he sent that letter to the Department of Education?
I think Republicans are totally falling behind McConnell. So one thing about the letter that McConnell sent, it wasn't just his signature on it. There were several other people who signed it with him. So he does have backing. He has support. He didn't jump out there kind of by himself and launch this. So that's one thing I certainly noticed. And I think Virginia Fox in the Education Labor Committee under the House, I think she too has a lot of support in the legislation that she's proposed to kind of tamp down on anti-racism teaching. So I think that not only have people fallen in line, I think they are getting more organized about how they approach it. I believe Fox wrote a letter as well, and she kind of, she's kind of calling out the Education Department on their endorsement of the 1619 Project, and she makes some really good arguments. This isn't kind of these letters aren't poorly written or poorly thought through. They seem like they're crafted very carefully, and it's not just outliers. There are people that are gathering together to write it and to endorse it. So I think they are definitely falling in line, and we will continue to see this as an issue of contention for many months to come.
In your reporting on this, does this break down into clean red versus blue lines, or are there fissures in the two parties over this? In other words, are there Republicans who are like, why is McConnell getting involved in this issue? He's just trying to stir up racial resentment. This isn't who Republicans should be.
I haven't seen too many fissures in terms of the Republican side. I think it's actually become an issue where roughly everyone can agree. You know, people are not hesitant to say, I agree that the 1619 Project is not accurate and we should not endorse it. I think after 4 years where we saw a great number of disagreements between the Republican Party or people afraid to speak out when they saw something that they didn't, you know, they couldn't really get behind, I think now we've kind of gone in the opposite direction where everyone feels empowered to say, yeah, we should push back against this and we should use every tool that we can to do that. It definitely struck me that former Secretary of Education under Donald Trump, Betsy DeVos, who's pretty much stayed under the radar for the most part since his presidency ended, but, you know, she was on Fox News not too long ago condemning the 1619 Project. I think Republicans from every corner have said this is something we can get behind.
Delise, thank you so much for your insights and your reporting.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
And that's our show. Our producers are Adrian Hurst and Annie Reese. Our senior producer is Jenny Amint. And our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. If you like what you hear, subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen. We'll take you behind the scenes of Capitol Hill again next week on another Playbook Deep Dive. Thank you for listening.